Welcome to a special interview episode of Broadway Radio. My name is Matt Tamanini. On today's episode, I'm in conversation with not one, but two of the people behind the original cast album for Figaro, an original musical. Up first, you will hear me chat with Will Nunziata, who is the co-conceiver and book writer and director for Figaro. And then we will hear from the leading lady of the show, Kaylee Capaldi. In our conversation, Will tells me the honestly fairly unlikely story about how he linked up with the show's other creator and co-book writer and composer, Ashley Janna, and how they pieced together this new show from a song that Ashley had written long before the idea for this musical ever took shape. Will also talks about the fact that the show will be having a premiere in London coming up fairly soon, although we couldn't get into a lot of details about that. He talks about working with Ashley, the entire cast, which also features Lily Bell Morgan, Benjamin Pajak, Mauricio Martinez, T. Oliver Reed, and Jake Workman. Will and I also discuss the show that he most recently directed off-Broadway, White Rose, and its upcoming cast album as well. And then I get the opportunity to chat with Kaylee. She is out in Utah right now after having been a member of the company of Titanic for 9 months. Now she is in rehearsals for the very first regional production of Frozen. She will play Elsa at the Tuacon Theater from May through October, as well as a few other shows in rep that we talk about. If you are not familiar with Kaylee, she was one of the background vocalists in Titanic, but went on for a ton of different roles, including Celine. And if you are somebody who ventures into the theater and singing sides of TikTok, chances are pretty good that you have come across her as well. She has over, as of last check, 280,000 followers on TikTok. So she is very fun and has an incredible voice. So we talk about everything that she has going on, Frozen, Titanic, and then doing something that was a little different with Figaro. So with all of that out of the way, here first is the show's co-conceiver, book writer, and director, Will Nunziata. All right, Will, thank you so much for chatting with us today. First off, this was something that when I first heard about Figaro, I was a little confused. This is an original story. This has nothing to do with The Barber of Seville, correct?
Nothing to do with it. But you know what it is? It's so interesting you mentioned that, Matt, because me and my amazing co-creator and the show's composer lyricist, we came up with the name of Figaro before even thinking about its association with obviously such a known IP, because the character is such a flamboyant showman. I mean, you can't get more showbiz or showmanship than Figaro. But I'll tell you, you know, look at, I love the idea of people coming to it, maybe thinking if they don't read the synopsis, it has something to do with it. It's at least a name that people kind of know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say that even though it is not based off of or even connected with the opera, it is a pretty epic score in and of itself. It is a much different style than what you're going to get with either The Marriage of Figaro or Barber of Seville. But you and Ashley kind of did a great job of building up a big epic, perhaps even operatic world inside the show itself.
Absolutely. And I think that was definitely something that was just in the stars, I guess, with the Figaro brand. But what I love too is working with the amazing art directors over in London at Bob King Creative. It was very important for Ashley and I, when we came up with our show image, that we set the terms for the audience, that this is from a woman's perspective, even if they don't know who Sienna is, but that even though Figaro, an original musical, is the name of it, as you know, and as listeners who have listened to the album and will eventually see in the show, it is definitely Sienna's story.
Okay, so you talk about Sienna. So give us the real quick elevator pitch as to what the show is about, from everything from the orphans to the shows and Figaro and all of that stuff.
Absolutely. So basically the few sentence elevator pitch would be it's set in mid-1800s Italy. Figaro, an original musical, is the hauntingly beautiful tale of Sienna, a young woman who dreams of singing but feels imprisoned by her life on her father's farm. When a chance encounter with two young orphans thrusts her into the life of a traveling performer, she meets the handsome Figaro, who promises to make all her dreams come true. But there's always a price to fame. It's part love story, part mystery. Sienna's journey to discover herself and live the life she always wanted is fraught with twists and turns until it culminates in a moment that will change the course of her life forever.
I feel like you have given that synopsis once or twice before, Will.
You know, Matt, I have, and I needed to really get it down to at least five sentences, because anyone that knows me, you know, five sentences can turn into 5 hours. So you're welcome to you and your audience.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, so where did the kernel of the idea for this show start? How did you and Ashley start collaborating on it? What was that process like?
It's a great question. It was actually in the height of the pandemic. It was April 2020. I was looking through Instagram, TikTok, trying to gain inspiration anywhere. And I came across Ashley's pop songs. And there was something about her songs, Matt, that like in my head, if there's one thing I'm proud of, I have really good gut instincts. And there was something about her pop songs that for me kind of felt like almost like little playlists. And I was like, you know what? We're all indoors. I'm going to just freaking direct message her on Instagram. I did. We set up a Zoom. And I said, Ashley, you know, I've listened to your pop songs. They're like little plays. Have you ever thought about creating a musical? And she goes, I cannot believe you just asked me that, Will, because that's been my dream since I was a little girl. Oh, and wow. I said, well, let's do it. We're going to probably be indoors for a while. And I said, you know, have you ever thought of any concepts or stories? She's like, not story, but Will, I wrote this one song years ago that I always felt was going to be an opening number. And I said, great, what's it called? And it's called Figaro. And so the opening number that you all will hear on the world premiere recording has basically not changed since Ashley created that original demo years. So that was what I like to call the flame that lit the pilot light. And from there, once a week, Matt, I would give Ashley assignments, and I would be like, okay, what happens if, okay, that's the beginning of the show. What happens if we then go back in time? And then she'd come back a week later with a song. And then we'd talk about the story some more. She'd go. So over a 2-year period, Matt, during the pandemic, we built the book. She wrote the music and the lyrics. And so that's how it kind of happened.
That's amazing. So when you messaged her, did you know her at all? Was it just somebody that you found on social media completely blind?
Completely blind. Wow. And, you know, again, you just never know. I mean, trying to use social media for the positive. Obviously, there are a lot of negatives. But, you know, in a time where connection was literally paused, I tried to put out there some feelers of artists that I felt that really excited me, that almost activated the little kid that always just kind of wanted to be a part of it, New York, New York. And frankly, Matt, a lot of fun collaborations came out of the pandemic, but I would say creating Figaro, an original musical with Ashley Janna, was the light in the dark during that time.
Yeah. What was it about her music and the pop songs that you heard and said, okay, that is other, beside the fact that you said they were kind of served as little mini playlists, but in terms of the music itself, what was it that you thought, oh, there might be a musical in her? And then how did that actually prove itself out during the creation of the show itself?
Yeah, another great question. Matt, you're really good at this. Have you done
Thank
this
you. I've been doing it for a while. Yeah.
The types of theater that I have always been interested in run the line of this dichotomy of being able to find the intimate within the epic. Here, Ashley, in these pop songs, was arranging, orchestrating, and creating melodies that were epic. Yet when you looked at the lyrics, they were so universal and so filled with emotion, and yet in such a small amount of real estate, she was able to pack such an emotional punch with very few words amidst these epic original beats that I'm very old school. I'm a Rodgers and Hammerstein, Jerry Herman, Sondheim. I know, but like, you know, but especially in the Rodgers and Hammerstein, Jerry Herman feel where like those melodies are just kind of like, you know, I can imagine the 40s, 50s, 60s, like people leaving the theater, tapping their toe. Like Ashley creates 21st century bops. And how it played out, we had that first song that she created, Figaro. And it, again, it was kind of like one of those dolls that, you know, can start really big.
Yeah.
And then you
the
start
nesting dolls.
Out.
Yeah. Russian nesting
exactly.
dolls. Yeah.
In or if we give the Onion analogy, that was the Onion. And what Ashley was able to do in both of us in creating the story in the book of the show, really peeling back who Sienna is, was, and wants to be. And just this cast of characters that came truly, Matt, out of those songs that Ashley would come back to me with each and every week over a 2-year period.
So as you approach this, you, one of the co-creators, you wrote the book, but you also direct a lot of shows. It's kind of like making those assignments and then building the book. Is that part and parcel with the director hat that you often wear, or are there different skills that go along with those that are completely separate as you are building a new musical?
I kind of look at it as like three different lanes that submerge. I'm a writer. I happen to be a director. And in this case, both are interweaving to create a third lane. You know, I was able to divorce myself as a director to write with Ashley the story in the book. However, I can't shut off the director in me because I'm a very visual director. So I'm also a best idea wins person. If I wrote this with Ashley and felt, you know what, I can't touch this sucker. We need someone else at 30,000 feet to direct this. There was something in conversation with Ashley that, you know, it felt right that through the writing of it, in that third lane of when the lanes converge, it definitely more and more as we were writing the story, I started staging it. And that's something that either it'll hit me or not. Like when I'm like going in for interviews to direct pieces that I'm not a writer of, right? If I can see it, I'm in. But if I can't, I'm the first person to be like, listen, it's great, not for me, but I'll give you 3 to 4 people that I think would knock this out of the park. So with Figaro, an original musical, I started to see how the different departments, set, costume, light, were going to orchestration, how it was all going to eventually come together.
I think this was in one of Sondheim's books. I might be misremembering that, but I think he said something about how when you were writing a show, if you are not thinking about how it's going to be staged, you're actually undermining the work itself. Because if you write something that is never going to work, either logistically in terms of like, oh, we can't do that on stage, or just like getting somebody from one costume to another costume, you're undercutting yourself. So having someone like Hal Prince, along with him, has the directing side throughout the process really worked. And it sounds like this actually was very similar for you guys, and that you were able to see all of the potential pitfalls while actually creating the piece itself.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned two of my heroes as a lover of theater, Sondheim, obviously, but also my directing hero, Hal Prince. You know, two of the things that, three of the things that were benchmarks for me that I thought of in terms of Hal, when both writing and then also when I'm starting to think about the directing of it, the first thing is, how was so much about the show curtain? What is that first image that people walk in with? And so even though we don't have a show curtain, it was very important for me and Ashley to figure out who what's that image, whether it's our show curtain or whether obviously it's our album cover. And it was very important that it be a female, that it be our Sienna with some sort of literal and figurative blindfold, as people will know when they read the, when they eventually see the show and even hear the album, they'll know what the blindfold, you know, literally means, but also figuratively. Meeting Figaro, what did that mean in terms of him unleashing this blindness throughout, you know, her life up until she meets him? Another thing that Hal always said, if you can set it in a black box, you're gold. So, you know, people think of Phantom of the Opera as this big epic musical, but the way that Hal built it and staged it was in a black box, and everything else was just ornament. And it was very less is more. And so that's how I kind of built Figaro with Ashley story-wise and how I'm thinking directing. And then thirdly, what I love so much about Hal is what I just mentioned earlier. He had turned down so many amazing musicals that he was asked to direct because he couldn't see it. And I think he even unabashedly says the one musical that he ever said yes to direct that he still could never see was Merrily. And, you know, he just could never see it. And so, yeah, those are my three Hal Princeisms.
Yeah, I love that. Love that. Well, you've mentioned the cast album a couple times, so I want to get to that. But before we do, you're saying that eventually people are going to see this on stage. I know you know when and where. How much can you tell us about those details?
Definitely. It will be in London. It will be on the West End, and it will be in early 2025. In what iteration, whether it's a full production, whether it's a semi-staged production, it will be definitely an event. If there's anything Ashley and I, in terms of putting on our vision board for this show, from the very beginning, we felt that after I heard the first few songs, Matt, of Ashley's, it was giving me this, Phantom meets Greatest Showman, touch of Tim Burton, European epic feel that I felt, and we both felt, would not so much be received, because I think a good show will be received well anywhere, but there was just something about London that we just like became obsessed over. And what I can say is through my dear friend Van Dien, who runs Center Stage Records, is a Grammy Award winning record producer, Tony Award winning theatrical producer. I had worked with him before on Little Black Book and a show that I co-created with Billy Reese. We did the album over the pandemic with Broadway Records. Now it's, you know, the bigger Center Stage Records. Van introduced Ashley and me to the amazing general managers and producers of Carter Dixon McGill, you know, West End producers, general managers who fell in love with the show. And that was just a conversation that has blossomed into this great working relationship and a business relationship. And I do want to just give a special shout out, Matt. I'm all about, giving credit where credit is due. Obviously, Ashley and I are producers on the world premiere recording of Figaro, an original musical. We also have as producers Van Dien. We have a Grammy and Tony nominated producer Mia Moravis. As co-producers, we have Michael Lehman and Andrew Burns.
Awesome. Well, speaking of the album, this is a show that no one really has seen yet. So when they dive into the album itself, one, what can they expect? But also, what kind of headspace do they have to get themselves into? Because they don't know that show curtain that you mentioned before. They don't know the visuals. They don't know the vibe of the show visually. What do they have to know going in to listen to the album?
I would definitely try and listen to it in full, in one take. I mean, granted, Ashley has written some songs that I know are going to be standalone hits because they're just bops. They're freaking bops. I can't, I'm just so proud of her. But I would say listen to it from beginning to end. We do have a digital booklet that comes with when you buy the album. You know, Ashley and I did provide kind of like little synopsis of, you know, where the characters are in that point in the story to just kind of give some sort of context, but to really close your eyes and to try to trust your own imagination. Because again, what Ashley has done, and we weren't able to put all of her beautiful orchestrations that I can't wait for people to listen to within the show. It reminded me a lot of what Danny Elfman has done for Tim Burton, Matt. You know, Ashley's created so many beautiful orchestral moments that apart from the songs, but also with the songs that add so much to the narrative that, you know, so many beautiful motifs, these Easter eggs that she puts in throughout that at the end, if you really kind of maybe on the second or third listen, oh my God, was that Sienna's psyche at the beginning and how it's like come back through. So anyway, there's a lot of fun Easter egg, but also important narrative elements through Ashley's orchestral moments alone that I think people should just kind of with abandon, trust their imagination, and just to know that they have within the digital booklet a kind of guide as well.
It seems like your recommendation is to kind of go back to an old school version of listening, because a lot of times if I'm listening to music in the car, I'm paying attention to where I'm driving, or if I'm at home, I'm doing something else. This is something where it's like, sit on the couch, get a glass of wine if you do that, listen to it on its own, let your head create the pictures, and don't distract yourself with anything else.
Amen, Matt. Absolutely. Again, both Ashley and I are kind of old souls at heart. We were the ones listening to albums in our bedrooms as 7-year-olds in full, playing out in our imaginations all of the characters. And so that is our recommendation. But again, what again I love so much about Ashley's writing is that what I fell in love with about Ashley's pop songs. She creates with each song little playlists that live on their own. And so however people are able to digest this album, whether it be first piecemeal, then maybe at one point altogether, it definitely is going to evoke probably shows that it might remind people of. But what I love so much about Ashley, she's an original and she's unapologetic. And, you know, one of my things that I love to tell actors, but also what I reminded Ashley often, is to wear her crown, to wear her crown. And she has such a depth to her that I'm really excited for people to witness with this album, and then later, obviously, the stage show.
Amazing. With the album, let's talk real quick about the voices that people will hear, because there are some fantastic voices. Ashley herself, as well as Mauricio Martinez, Kaylee Capaldi, T. Oliver Reed, and Jake Workman, as well as Ben Pajak, who I think a lot of theater fans know how great he is, despite how young he is, and Lily Bell Morgan. When you put this group together, what were you looking for? Obviously, they have to be able to sing the notes that Ashley has written, but like, what were the qualities that you were trying to get from casting these exact actors and singers for the roles for the album?
I know this has become an ism of mine, but it's the truth. Whether it's on the stage or in recording, I love once in a generation talent. I love people, to quote Judy Garland, step into their power of being the first-rate version of themselves and not a second-rate version of anyone else. Mauricio Martinez has been an oft collaborator. I've cast him in many readings and shows. He's a once-in-a-generation talent. Jake Workman, I saw them perform 2 months before we began recording this over the summer at a cabaret. We were looking for Argia for the album. I ran right up to them after the show and I said to them right away, I said, listen, I know you get this, or we all get this a lot in showbiz, you know, you're in, kid, but I'm telling you right now, you are going to be one of the leads on a world premiere recording of a fantastic musical. You will get the demos tonight. And that night they got it. They said yes. I one song from Jake Workman is a once in a generation talent. Kaylee Capaldi is someone I did not know. I knew of her mother. Well, I didn't even realize I knew who Lee Zimmerman was for years as a theater fan. Obviously, her mom, Lee Zimmerman, is the Olivier Award winning Broadway yeah. West End veteran, right? But when Kaylee came into the picture, I wanted to cast a Sienna for this album in the old school Barbra Streisand funny girl moment. I wanted to give someone their funny girl moment. When Kaylee, she sent a tape, I was so floored by the different levels of comedic, dramatic, but the vocal technique and the commitment to acting, once in a generation talent. T. Oliver Reed has been a friend for years, Broadway legend, done dozens of Broadway shows, knocked it out of the park. Someone with gravitas, But someone with that voice that could tell a story. Again, what's the assignment? This recording, that voice has so many textures and colors that we needed for Sienna's father. And Benjamin Pajak, a fan. I witnessed him in Music Man. I witnessed him in Oliver. And my God, that was the North Star. And look at this, Matt. You never know. I always tell everyone, you never know in this business. Benjamin Pajak, I was like, how do we get to him? I looked up who his rep was. Barry Kolker, the amazing Barry Kolker, shout out to Barry, was my childhood agent, Matt. So that I gave Barry a call. And I got to connect with Benjamin and his mom, and we had a great conversation they were in. And I said, listen, Barry, let's do business. Benjamin said, yes, I want to pick the little girl from your roster. He sent me a slew of incredible talent. I heard Lily Bell Morgan, and I was like, and Ashley was like, once in a generation talent. So that's how it shook. And also, it was very important for me that Ashley be a voice on this as Lucia. And even though she was a little hesitant because she's so humble and, no, oh, let's give it to someone else. I said, Ashley, no offense, but as the show's director, it'll most likely be someone else. Why not have you be the first Lucia? And so I'm really happy that she wore her crown and stepped into that. So that's the short answer, Matt.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure there's a long one too. I'm sure we could get into that at some point. I think I almost made you spit out whatever you're drinking there. But we'll wrap up here. Let's get away from Figaro for just a second. This is not the only show you have recently worked on. White Rose just ended its off-Broadway run this past Sunday, right? Yeah. So just less than a week ago. I've heard rumblings that there might be a cast album from that coming as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for mentioning about that, Matt. And again, thank you so much for having me today. White Rose, the musical, was such a beautiful spiritual experience for me. Not to get all woo-woo, Matt. White Rose, the musical, is about here in the States, not many people knew about these group of university students, German university students during Nazi Germany, who spoke truth to power against Hitler by writing and duplicating and distributing leaflets. And it was such an amazing experience with a killer cast. The book and lyrics by the amazing Brian Belding, a score by the luminous Natalie Bryce, orchestrations by Grammy and Tony Award winner Charlie Rosen, musical direction by Sheila Ramesh. And I want to give a special shout out to, once again, Van Deen. I want you to all those young listeners out there, you never know who your friends and when things are going to come about when you get to work with them. I've been a friend of Van Deen and a fan of Van for over a decade. And it's just in these past 3 years, this is our third project together. And he introduced me to the amazing Michael Kreuter at Yellow Sound Label, who listened and came to the show and loved it. And also Jeff Laurinaitis, the angel Jeff Laurinaitis, one of our amazing lead producers on the show and our executive producer on the album, really was stepped up. And I'm excited to say that sometime in May of 2024, you will get the incredible world premiere recording of White Rose. And I want also people to just keep an eye out for on all socials at White Rose the Musical for the next incarnation, I will say, of this piece.
You've got teases everywhere, Will, on social media, in the West End, on whatever music streaming platforms or purchasing platforms. You've got stuff everywhere. That's pretty exciting. So, well, I'll wrap up with one last question. You've talked about the once in a generation talent that is on the Figaro and original musical album. If they're once in a generation, if you're going over to do the performance in London, where are we in terms of casting that? Are we going to potentially hear any of these people? I know there's union and equity and international travel rules that you have to get into, but what are you looking to do in terms of casting for whatever form the London version takes on?
That's the million-dollar question, Matt. And thank you for asking, putting me in the most awkward position.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or million-pound question, too, if it's going to be in the UK. So, yeah.
Touché, my friend. Touché.
Yeah.
Look at, I'm all about one step at a time. What's the assignment? The assignment it for these past few months has been landing the venue and the dates. We do have that. I cannot announce that yet.
Okay.
Casting is going to be fascinating because obviously we have these amazing performers on the album. And obviously no one will be able to ever take that away from them. And I've reminded them from the beginning, right, that you are the first, bottom line. No one can ever take that away. The West End casting is going to be interesting, right? Because it's a different assignment. In an ideal world, I'd bring everyone from the album over. Are we going to be able to do that? Probably not. But know though, with my director hat on, when it comes to the West End incarnation, I want to also really respect the producers and general managers over there, right? In terms of what that West End version of Figaro, an original musical, looks like, which will look probably different than when we do the Broadway version, when we do the movie. So I'm trying to be general here, Matt, and
No,
not get
well,
too much.
no, that makes sense because especially the respecting their producers because those producers are going to want to sell tickets in London and there might be some names that might do that a little bit better for London audiences than maybe people that are well known on the other side of the pond. So that makes sense. I didn't mean to put you in a weird spot, but it is exciting, especially the way you talked about it.
It's a great question. It's something that I grapple with. I'm an Italian, Matt, so I'm emotional. I want to bring everyone over. But it look at this world premiere cast recording is unlike anything I've ever been a part of. But also, Matt, and I know you can relate to this. It activates the 7-year-old little Will who dreamed about being a part of the theater. I get excited forgetting I was a part of the creation of it. And so that's what gets me excited about what this album is going to do for the young Matts and young Wills out there who just want to be a part of it, New York, New York, in an original way with this original first cast. And an original musical and an original story. So that's a mouthful, but
No, that's great. I love that. Well, I wish you the best on whatever decisions you have to make moving forward, and very excited to see what the next incarnation of this show looks like, both over there and then hopefully over here as well, not too long after that. So, well, thank you so much. Good luck with everything, and I'm sure hopefully we'll get a chance to check in whenever the next bit of news that you want to tease comes up.
You will get the exclusive, my friend. Thank you so much for providing such a safe space. Thank you, my friend.
Now it's time to talk with the show's leading lady, Kaylee Capaldi. We discuss all things Figaro, Frozen, Titanic, TikTok, and more. Okay, so I did check the weather, and out in Utah right now, I think it's actually warmer than New York. So the cold not bothering you currently, from what I understand.
That is true.
So you are out in Utah at the Tuakon Theater Center, this huge, gorgeous outdoor amphitheater. You are getting ready to start the very first regional production of Disney's Frozen. You are playing Elsa. That's exciting. And that theater is so gorgeous. Like, a lot of outdoor theaters are nice, but that's a special place.
Absolutely. Well, it's such an honor to be working on this show. Our creative team with Michael Heitzman and Robbie Roby, we are so blessed to have the opportunity to do this show here at Tuacon because I believe that there's no place else in this country that we can do the first regional premiere of Frozen justice like we're going to be able to do here. You know, being outdoors, we have the opportunity to create so much magic that we couldn't be able to achieve indoors. So I think it's an amazing place to be telling this story, especially since, you know, the source material is just so connected to nature, and we have the opportunity to be in nature literally every single night. So yeah, it's going incredibly well. We just finished our first week of rehearsals and we're about to dive into another week. And it's just a dream come true. Playing Elsa has been one of my dream roles for many years now. Frozen on Broadway was actually the very first Broadway show I ever auditioned for as a teenager.
Oh, wow.
So it's very full circle for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a show, especially Elsa, that is a very big sing. You are used to big sings. You are known for big sings. When you go into a show like this, that is going to be, you know, most regional theater runs are a month or two. This is starting on May 3rd, running into mid-October. Like, this is a long, healthy run for a regional show. Having done all of the Titanic and the Celine stuff and all of that, how do you get your voice prepared not only to do a big sing, but to do a big sing outdoors?
Yeah, this is actually my first time working in an outdoor theater. So it presents a whole host of, I won't say problems, but challenges, because I think they're healthy challenges if you look at them the right way. I am so grateful to Titanic for so many reasons, but especially because of how it challenged me to grow as a singer and a performer, and just the stamina that you build up naturally singing Celine Dion songs every night is priceless. It's very, very valuable. So I'm grateful to have that built into muscle memory and all the strength that I built up over those 9 months on the Ship of Dreams. But yeah, I think this rehearsal process for Frozen is very, very beneficial, because not only are we rehearsing Frozen, but we've rehearsed our other show, because we're in rep for all of these months. So we're doing Anastasia, and then in July we open up Jersey Boys. So working on three shows at once, two shows for now, and then we add a third in another month or two. But that's such a great builder of stamina as well. And I get to work out my cover brain that I had in Titanic. I have the fortune of playing some principal roles in all the shows here, but now I'm really like, all right, what is the climate? What are my tricks for the dryness and the heat and, you know, using my nebulizer all day and then drinking my gigantic 128 ounce water bottle. Sorry, our listeners can't see just how big that water bottle was.
But, it was huge. I can testify. It was huge. Yeah.
So, yeah. And then just, you know, relying on the support of my fellow castmates, who are all fabulous and wonderfully talented. So yeah, I'm really grateful to have had that opportunity to build up that vocal stamina by singing Celine.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Titanic before we get into Figaro. You were involved with, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think, did you basically start that show more or less right out of school? I mean, you've been with that for quite a while, right?
Yeah. So I graduated from Columbia University in 2022. And I didn't join Titanic until this past July. So 2023, I was not part of the Asylum cast, but then we moved to the Daryl Roth where we are now. And I joined the cast about 6 months into that run. And so it was absolutely incredible. Yes, very fresh out of school. I'd had the opportunity to do some other professional regional gigs right before that. And then also, you know, blessed with my experience of working from when I was a kid and growing up with parents in the performing arts. It was definitely not a new experience, but, it was 9 months, and, it was basically, I finished my last show on Sunday night, And then I flew here to Utah on Monday morning. So it was a very quick turnaround, and had to process a lot of those, a lot of that grieving period already in rehearsals for a new show. So, but it's wonderful. I'm still in contact with my family there, and yeah, it's just been the most wonderful experience.
That show has been so fun to watch. I mean, I've seen it multiple times, but it's been so fun to kind of watch the evolution of the show as new stars come in, whether that's different Celines or different Roses and Jackson, all of those folks. But it just seems to have really kind of hit the right notes with audiences. It feels like it's something that people needed at the time. And, you know, we don't see a lot of commercial off-Broadway shows run for as long as Titanic has. And that is, I think, is a testament not only to the show and the performances, but just to how right it works at this time with audiences and what they're looking for.
100%. Yes. Marla Mandel and Constantine Rasulli and Ty Blue, our creators and writers, they found this magical combination of harnessing the power of our collective love for the movie Titanic and our collective involvement in pop culture and how much we as a society just need to be able to laugh and go someplace where we can escape whatever we're dealing with, whatever crazy stuff is going on in the world or in our personal lives. We can just come together for 90 minutes and cackle and just have a giggle together and enjoy, you know, the best of Celine Dion's discography and her amazing body of work, and being able to honor her personality and her, you know, ever-present legacy. It's just such a magical, unique combination that is so out of left field that it works. I always like to encourage people who have never seen the show before to go into it as blind as possible. Like, I hope, you know, it helps to have watched the movie Titanic, that's for
Yes.
sure. Because then you're gonna understand the plot and the characters and what exactly we are sending up. And what we're referencing, because a lot of the times we have some lines that are lifted right out of the movie. So, as you know, touch points for people to, oh, I remember that, relate to, amidst the wonderful chaos going on.
I don't, my opinion, I don't think we have enough silliness in theater these days. We're like, we just need that at some times. And the unbridled goofiness and silliness and playfulness that that show brings, I think, has been an elixir for a lot of people. And that's why I have friends who have been 10, 15, 20 times to see the show, because sometimes you just need that. For you guys as a cast, especially for you, if you bounce through playing multiple parts in the show, how do you hit those right notes? Because the lines are one thing, they're funny, they're well written, as you mentioned, but like you've got to walk a kind of a tightrope to make sure that you're getting the story, but also getting the silliness and not going too far in either direction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, a lot of our show is improv. So I think that's also what keeps folks coming back so much is that, like, oh, you're never going to see the same show twice, guaranteed. Not just because of the improv, but because, you know, you're probably going to see a cover on one night. And that's going to be a totally different experience because they have a different approach to the improv, which is, you know, even funnier or different in a way. And so yeah, I think it's a great challenge to be able to rehearse the show, learn the show, understand the soul of the show, and how you access that balance between you know, honoring the material and making it your own. I think that's a very big challenge. And honestly, that's a wonderful thing that we're you know, dealing with here at for Frozen is that how do we take this original material that is so well known and so loved by everybody and making it our own? How do we add new light to it? How do I take this character who has been played so masterfully by so many powerful women and find my take on it? So yeah, and Titanic was and still is such an incredible place to explore all of that. And you know, we're still going strong. Thank God. Thank the theater gods.
Well, one more question on Titanic, because you mentioned the improv. when you go on for Celine, how much are you able to prepare for that? I guess, can I call it the improv section where Jack and Rose have to follow along? I'm not sure exactly how it's like. How do you prepare for that? How much do you know going in you're going to say? How much of it is off the cuff? How do you do that, especially when it's not your everyday track?
Yeah. Well, when you are covering a role like Celine, and when you know that that track has this great responsibility of a 5, 10, 15 minute improv section right in the middle, of, you know, depending on how it goes.
Yeah.
I think there's a part of your brain that's always, from the first day of rehearsal on, just turned on, like alerted to, oh, okay, what's going on in pop culture, in the media, in the news that could be funny? What do we need to look out for this week? You know? So there's always that. But then when you've done it enough times, and I ended up doing Celine, I believe 33 or 34 times in my 9 months, you end up finding that there are certain structures that you like to use that can sort of serve as a blueprint. And you can say, all right, well, I know if I hit that goalpost there, then I can take the rest of it here. And, you know, I'm still making it up as I go along. I don't think the delivery is ever the same. But honestly, a lot of it is driven by just trying to make my cast members break. I just want to see if I can send Lindsay into a laughing fit, or if I can send Michael, our Jack, like if I can make him laugh, which will make Lindsay laugh, or, you know, any of our wonderful covers. So it really depends so much on trust too, because when you feel like you are supported, then you feel so much braver to try things out, and comfortable to, really just free fall in the most exhilarating way.
Do you have a favorite bit that you did that made your cast members break?
Well, the one that I kept returning to was definitely harnessing some of my impressions that I do. And one of my favorite things that I used to do was I would do like this ASMR bit where I would...
Oh, I'm cringing already. Jack, I'm cringing already. Yeah.
I know. Ugh. I would make Jack or Rose do ASMR into each other's ear, but like impersonating different celebrities. So sometimes Nicole Kidman would come and do the AMC monologue, or Hilary Duff and Jennifer Coolidge. Like, I just loved doing the wackiest things. But yeah, it's been incredible to also be around for so many different interpretations and iterations of our Celines. Nicole Parker, Jackie Burns, our incredible swing, Tess Marshall. And when I first joined the show, our swing was Christina Waltz. So yeah, it's amazing to see. And then of course, Marla Mandel. I never had the honor of being in the cast with her at the same time, but I was able to learn so much from her, and she was so present during the rehearsal process and generous in, you know, sharing her insight into the role. And she, as far as I was concerned for my Celine, she was my Bible. She was the blueprint. You know, I based all my choices off of her because I think I had to, you know, that's
she wrote it. Yeah.
That I mean, the Celine. She is Celine. Yeah. Yes, of course. Yeah.
Tuff sings both Frozen and Titanic, a much different type of sing, or at least a different type of show in a lot of ways, is Figaro, an original musical. I spoke with Will about this, and I think at least when I first started seeing the press releases for this, I was like, oh, a new take on The Barber of Seville or whatever. No, this is a completely different show, not an opera score. As you started approaching this piece for this original album, what did you have to do to kind of get into a different style of singing to kind of balance out some of the stuff you'd been doing on stages, you know, as it's different than what you're going to be doing in the recording studio?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a lot of that's such a great point, because balancing the difference, between doing a show 8 times a week versus coming into a studio and recording a brand new world premiere album, It's a very different skill set. And I was really grateful to have had both at the same time, because I felt like I was, you know, still going to the vocal gym every night at Titanic, but being able to work out my voice in a different way during the day. The score is a really incredible blend of pop and contemporary musical theater. So a lot of that was very much the style of Titanic, but it felt a lot more demanding in that there was so much ground to cover for this world premiere album. We had a lot that we wanted to share with everybody. And a lot of those choices and decisions were being made just in the moment in the recording studio. Ashley Janna, our composer, wrote such a fantastic score with such addictive, memorable melodies. But there were also times where she'd be like, all right, I want to change this word, or I want to try something different with this melody. What do you think? Like, where can we take this? And so it was very validating and gratifying as a performer and a singer to feel like my choices mattered in this process.
Yeah.
And it ended up being so collaborative. And it still is to this day. Like, after our world premiere concert, at Green Room 42 at the start of March, we were making story decisions like leading up to that day. You know, we're still working on it. So yeah, it's a fantastic thing to be given the opportunity to feel very versatile on the projects that you're working on, which this year I felt very lucky to be able to do.
Obviously, we've talked a lot about the vocal and singing side of your career, but the acting is the other side of things that I'm interested in. When you're doing an original album, but not having done an actual run of the show, as the acting side of the performer process, how do you go about filling in the gaps for yourself and with the writers of the show to make sure that you are, no pun intended, I guess, hitting all of the right story notes to make sure that the emotions are right, even though you have never actually played the role on stage?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. It usually is the other way around. You have a run and you have time to be on stage and understand these characters, and then you record the album. But so much of our story is song driven. And there's such a, you know, even just the story itself is based in music and singing and the desire to share your gift with as many people as possible. That's my character's whole dream in the show and what motivates her so much. So it made sense to give our audiences a musical touch point before we entered into the story. But the storytelling, the lyrics, and the way that this album is set out is very helpful in that you're able to follow a storyline throughout the listening experience. And then on the flip side of it, as the performer recording all of it, you know, Will, our director, was, you know, my indispensable touchstone through all of this. I was like, all right, so we're starting this new song. Where are we in this story? What is she going through? Where are we coming from? You know, we made sure to always talk about where are we coming from, what's going on right before this song, what's driving her to sing this song now, and where do we want her to get by the end of it, so that we have a clear, intelligible arc throughout the whole story. And then just being able to do that on stage at Green Room 42 for an audience was just so liberating, because it was also the first time that all of us as a cast had been in the same room singing this music together.
I was gonna ask, yeah.
We all recorded our parts very much separately. And I was actually the last person to record all the parts. So I was able to listen to all of them in the headphones as I was recording. But then I was like, I want to be in a room with you. I want to play. I want to collaborate. You get to discover so much more in person looking at your scene partner, because that's what they are. And ultimately it came down to putting the acting and the story first, because we want to tell the story and we want our characters to legitimately feel like they are incapable of speaking what they are feeling. Like, we have to sing it because that's the only way we can truly express how we're feeling. And yeah, just the openness and willingness to go to that vulnerable place was the biggest gift from our cast.
When you finally got to get on stage with the rest of the company at Green Room 42, was there anything that surprised you? Maybe did something that hit differently because you were actually able to have that interaction with them? Or did anything feel different or feel not feel different than what you had done, but feel different than what you expected it to feel like when you were able to have that eye contact and interaction?
Yes, absolutely. I was able to feel so dropped in to the character. And it wasn't just the connection to the cast members, but a lot of it was just to the audience and feeling their energy and being able to look into their eyes, because Sienna has quite a few 11 o'clock numbers, quote unquote. And so much of that depends on her relationship with the audience, not just a physical audience in reality, but a lot of this is her singing to a fictional audience. You know, she runs away and finds herself separated from her life and joins this circus with a really enigmatic, mysterious leader named Figaro, and she fulfills her lifelong dream of being a singer and, you know, reaching audiences. And so I was able to feel a lot more connected to her and to the story by being able to have a real audience in front of us. And there was a story change that we decided on that day in soundcheck, actually, and it came to fruition on stage that there's a song called "I'll Sing for You," Reprise. And it's called Reprise because it's the music is based on this melody that she sings to herself when she's lonely. It represents a lot of the loss that she feels for her mother who disappeared when she was young. And it represents this desire, primal desire to be a singer and be an artist. And so it's her very first time singing in front of a crowd, in front of anyone. And she's so nervous. She's just sung this song with Gia, who is the costume designer played by Jake Workman on the album. And she's just terrified. And so much is riding on this moment. And there's this big soprano into whistle tone climax in the middle of the song that we created in the studio. I was like, all right, well, if we're going to go there, why don't we just go all the way and see how high we can go? But she then has two more songs later in the show that represent her fully coming into her own. So it felt like it didn't really make sense to get there right away in that first song. Like, we needed some place for her to still go, but she needed to be able to experience some sort of dramatic failure in the middle of the song. What if she breaks? What if she can't hit the note? And how exciting is that as an audience to see, oh my God, is she gonna fail? Is she gonna give up? Is she gonna just leave? Or is she gonna decide to push forward and keep going and really commit to this dream that she has? And we thought that that would be a much more exciting moment as an audience member to invest in this character for the rest of the story.
That's amazing. That's fascinating. That's very interesting to see how those kind of things happen in the spur of the moment at a soundtrack. Mm-hmm. That's great. Have you thought about the fact you mentioned Marla as being your Bible? Now that you've recorded this album, like, whatever happens in the future, if this thing gets done regionally or, you know, in schools someday, like, you're going to be the Bible for Sienna. Like, is that weird? Like, that seems like that would be a pretty heavy, cool career moment.
It's incredible. It's really amazing. And I hope it does have that sort of life. I think it deserves that sort of life. And it's an awesome weight to have and responsibility to have, because you're shaping this character and this story. And it's never just happening in a vacuum, right? It's extremely collaborative with Will, our director and co-book writer, and Ashley. So it's always a collaboration community effort as a cast and creative to build this story. But I hope that that happens one day. And I will always be here to talk about Sienna because I love her and I love this story.
Yeah. Well, I'll wrap it up and bring Sienna back to where we started with Elsa. Sienna kind of runs away and runs, whether purposely or not, runs to the things she's always wanted. And Elsa kind of does the reverse and runs away from a lot of things as well. Is there a lesson in either or both of those that you think are important for anybody who sees the shows or just anybody in general that you kind of learned and picked apart from these two different characters who approach what they want and what they're afraid of and what they're excited about in two very different ways?
Oh my God, what a brilliant question. Wow. That's a gorgeous way to put it. I think it's very revealing of who we are as humans and how we decide to face our fears based on how we're raised. I think Elsa and Sienna share a lot, even though they have some differences in how they like to handle their problems. Both of them are told from a very early age that who they are and what they want is not okay. And they're wrong for feeling a certain way. You know, Elsa is told from the earliest of ages that she will grow up to be a monster and people will be fearful of her. And she hurts her best friend and in the whole world. And she fundamentally believes that she is wrong and she cannot be who she is without hurting others. Sienna dreams of feeling fulfilled and artistic and creative because that's what her mother encouraged, but her mother disappeared. And so her father is the one who is saying, you can't do this. You have to help on the farm. You have to be a part of this family. This is not realistic for you. And your mother does not believe in you anymore because she's gone. And so I think what that creates is either the decision to accept the narrative around you or refuse it. And what's exciting for me as the actor is figuring out why a character makes that choice, what they choose and why. They are really informing each other through this process, which I'm very grateful for. And it's not something that I really expected. They feel sort of disparate and physically very far away, yeah. Utah versus New York. But there's still that connection that I feel artistically that is going to really be valuable going forward.
Amazing. Well, I'll end on this last question that is not about any of those shows we've talked about, but it's instead about another place that you have kind of gotten some acclaim. You're kind of are you a social media influencer now? Can we officially call you that? Cause like you're pretty big on the TikTok. So when you look at like what that means in the world for an artist like yourself, and then just somebody of your generation, like that's something that people do, like, but you've got like 250,000 followers or something more than that. Like that's a lot of people that follow you to hear you belt crazy things and be silly. Like that's kind of a cool thing.
It's very, very cool. That really just started as a pandemic hobby. Yeah. I was sitting at home doing online classes for college and feeling incredibly drained artistically with no outlet to feel creative and no opportunity to be with other artists and performers. And so I had to turn to this online community or else I would have gone insane. Cause I was like, I need to still sing. I need to do something artistic and musical with my day. And so it was such an escape. And then as it grew, you know, I had to learn how to play the game. I had to learn how to please the algorithm and jump on trends and do what you have to do to keep momentum going. But, it's been so much fun and it still is. In rehearsal periods, I find that I have to sort of take a step back from the social media world because after rehearsing from 10 to 6 every day, you're kind of like, I need to unplug my brain for a bit. but there's also that encouragement that I'm trying to give to myself of like, what you create does not have to be perfect and refined and effortless and flawless. Like, it's okay to show that human side of you, because that's what's gonna be the most relatable to an audience. That's what people are gonna hook onto and love to keep coming back to, because they can see themselves in that.
Yeah, I think that there's a good kind of blend of what we're talking about with Titanic between those great vocals, but that silliness, I think, is something that people really want on especially TikTok. They want somebody who is having fun doing what they're doing, and whether it's for a 90-minute show off Broadway or for 90 seconds on social media, like, people still need and crave that type of stuff. So it's very different types of performance, but still at the core has a lot of the same roots.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one thing to just have this incredible, you know, it's one thing to just do a perfect riff and hit a really high note and do it in the most perfect, flawless way. And it's one thing to say, oh, wow, that sounded great. But like, how can I relate to it? You know, how can I find myself in that? And that's where comedy and silliness is just such a bridge between people, especially total strangers who may never even meet, you know. Yeah.
Well, Kaylee, thank you so much for talking about all of this. I'm sorry that I took so much time on your day off, but this is very exciting. All of the stuff coming up, Figaro has been such a joy to kind of watch it grow and to see what happens next. I spoke with Will, like I said, and he's already kind of teasing announcements for what's next with the show. So she's shaking her head. She's not saying a word, but she is shaking her head. You can't see that right now. But whatever happens with that, of course, first and foremost, have a fantastic run out in Utah with Frozen. And I'm sure that there will be, after you settle into everything, some very good TikToks from Tuacon as well. So congratulations. Good luck with everything. And hopefully we'll get a chance to chat again in the future.
Thank you. I would love that. This has just been such a joy to talk with you.